is work I did jointly with Glenn Webb at Vanderbilt, who's part of that big VICBC that Sandy mentioned or wrote this morning, as well as Sandy himself. And IPAM's up there because it's where the talk is, but they've also been kind enough to host me for the entire program. So this is about 2 months into a 3 month program, and I've been enjoying it immensely. So I have to thank IPAM. The title requires a little bit of explanation. So the first two words are computational methods, and that I think is clear enough. And then I put and results. There's a little bit of a double entendre. The hope is that the results show, pretend that this has something to do with tumor invasion, but really there's a long and rich history in numerical analysis of writing down methods that you don't use to solve anything and that actually can't be used to solve anything. And so the fact that I was able to implement these methods in software to get something prompted the title. Then structured multiscale. Well, they're multiscale because we're going to look at components like the cell cycle, which is at the cell level, genetic differences, which you could state are at the molecular level, and then the tumor, which is at a tissue or higher level. And then the term structure comes in because the representation of the cell cycle is going to be using, we're going to use a so-called structured variable. At first we're going to use age and size, and then we're going to simplify to just age. So the T-line is, we're going to have an introduction, we'll talk a little bit about it. Mm-hmm. Then we're going to go over the model species, the general model, and the simplifications, and I'll have a slide that flashes up. But this is essentially a translation of Sandy's hybrid discrete continuous model that he talked about this morning for tumor invasion, so not the angiogenesis stuff, but the tumor invasion stuff, into these continuous variables. And then we'll go over the computational methodology, just an overview of the combination of methods. And then the focus is on what my main accomplishment to date, which is these moving grid Galerkin methods for handling age structure. Then briefly discuss some of the convergence results, really just state what they are and refer to them. And then go into the computations of the simplified model. Comment on what we did for parameters. This is really the illustrative study at this point, more from the computational side. And then present a couple of pictures, and then go into some of the conclusions. So what was the goal of this work? Well, it wasn't to actually model anything yet, but to rather develop a computational framework for the models and also a modeling framework. And what you want is we want the dynamics of sufficiently large invasive tumors. So you look at Sandy's model, and it's a cell-based model. And so there's a maximum size at which it applies, and also the behavior of the model at that scale, we saw some nice, beautiful fingering, almost fractal-like patterns emerging. And then when you look at larger tumors, Louisa had shown some nice little nuggets. We see that, well, they're either quite smooth, or when they do have irregularity, when they're larger and have irregularity, they're bumpier. And so the physical, not just the scale difference, but you also get different kind of morphology for these largest tumors. And so the idea is we have to now use a continuous representation in order to affordably do the computations. But we still want to keep in those smaller scale processes, or at least some of the smaller scale processes that Sandy was able to include in his model. And it sort of give some focus to the work, and it's also what Glenn really is most enthusiastic about, is how the chemotherapies, particularly certain chemotherapies that target cells in different stages of their cell cycle or only affect cells in a particular stages of their cell cycle, as well as essentially, for want of a better term, the population genetics of a tumor. You have different genotypes or phenotypes, and how do they respond to things like drug resistance. Now, the goal of the talk is a little bit different than the goal of the work. I want to argue two things. One, that using physiological structure, in this case we're going to use age and size to start with, but then we're going to drop size and we're just going to use age to represent certain traits, such as position in the cell division cycle. There's going to be a useful upscaling of these traits in the fully continuous model. I say upscaling because there's really a lot of complicated molecular stuff that goes in to determining how cells behave in terms of their position in their cell cycle, and we give a simpler representation that we believe is sufficient, or we hope will be sufficient for the just kind of for the larger tumor modeling. And then, once I've convinced you that you want to have an age structure using this kind of continuous variable, that the way you're going to solve the equations are the moving grid Galerkin methods that I developed. So the model, well, the model in this paper is essentially a translation to fully continuous equations of Sandy's HDC model. And so if you're happy with that model, then hopefully you're happy with at least the underpinnings of this model, if not the full implementation. And if you're unhappy with that model, then you will be unhappy with this model as well.
You're going to show us the equation?
Yes, I will. So when you say something's multi-scale, it's such a broad term. And so you want to explain your multi-scaleness, or here the multi-scaleness. And so we have the components. Well, we have what I talk about, molecular, essentially genetic scale, cellular, this is the age or size variables, and the tissue scale, or the larger tumor scale. And these different physical scales induce different time scales into the problem. Now, typically, especially when you're looking at physical systems and these multi-scale problems, it's the smaller scales that have the faster time scales. And so when people talk about working on multi-scale, and you look in the journal of multi-scale modeling and simulation, at least a lot of the early work that appeared there and the work of the editorial staff that founded that journal, they did a lot of work in what was called homogenization. They said, we have these lower scale processes and we need to think very, very carefully about how we embed them in a model that handles these higher scale processes, but we still want to get rid of them in some manner, so you have some representation of that. And we actually, and it's also referred to as upscaling. And in a sense, we're doing it, but we're only doing a partial upscaling. We're not getting rid of age entirely. We're not getting rid of the cell cycle entirely. We're just saying, instead of the molecular things that go on, the biochemical things that go on with the age, with the cell cycle, we're going to use an age representation. Same thing that Sandy did this morning. He had positioned the cell cycle represented by age. But in our problem, once we go and we use this age structure, the relationship is inverted. The smaller physical scales actually have progressively slower time scales. Mutation events occur on a much lower time scale than the cell cycle does. Not every time you divide, you get a mutation. And cells in the cell cycle actually occur on scales of, I've heard, 10 to 12 hours. And my understanding is it can be quite variable depending on the type of cancer. But that's the typical time scales. Whereas when you're looking at movement, and especially movement, it's relative. And as a numerical analyst, when I talk about time scale, I have to be careful because I discretize these things, and my discretization tells me how long my time steps have to be to resolve things. And so I think of the time step as the time scale. And so typically that corresponds to what a physicist or a chemist would think of as a time scale. But anyway, the time scales of the cell cycle, typically the age distributions are typically quite smooth. And so the fastest scales are the spatial scales, the haplotaxis, the diffusion scales. So we want to take advantage of that. And so this is how we're going to have age represent the cell cycle. So we have a probability density function of cell ages at division. And so you go through, and you go through gap one, synthesis, gap two, and then you divide, and you undergo a mitosis phase that has some variable length, depending on some sort of PDF. And this is a formulation that's really Glenn Webb's, and I think, I'm not sure about the curve in particular, but the precise formulation we use is Glenn's. It goes back about 1989. When we get to it, I'll talk about some of the things that we're not satisfied, or at least I'm not satisfied. But the original idea, at least as far as I know, goes back to George Bell in 1968, and that's to use age structure for cell division in particular. Age structure itself is probably one of the very, very first things done in mathematical biology. It goes back to Lotka. 1907 with this integral formulation. Sharp and Lotka flesh it out quite a bit more, and so it's a 1911 paper that's more often cited as the original work. And then the PDE form that's more commonly used today was done in 1926 by McKendrick and
Eckert. Oh, by the way, can I ask a question?
Yes.
So when you say the PDF is a density function, right? So what does that actually mean? Does that mean?
So this is probability of division. So you're not going to divide if you're in gap one synthesis or gap two, but you have a mitosis stage, and at some point in the mitosis stage, you're going to divide.
So the vertical axis is probability.
Yeah, it's probability. And because this is primarily angiogenesis workshop, we're going to find field assumption that Sandy made this morning about the vasculature. And if you're really unhappy about that, I'll assure you that future work will include an explicit vasculature. I've just got somewhere. So now we get into the equations. So we have some model species. What I'm going to present is a very, very general model, far more complicated than what we actually want to solve. And so I want to say something about doing that. So this work was published in Multiscale Modeling Simulations, which is a SIAM journal, and at least the editor-in-chief and about 50% of the editorial board are computational scientists. And the bulk of the work has been on the computational methods, or synthesizing all these computational methods and putting them into this framework. And so having a larger model is something that when you're dealing with a more complicated model, when you're developing computational methods, is an important thing to do. You want to anticipate what kind of wrinkles will come in and so forth. It's not what you want to do when you want to actually engage in proper modeling. But at the same time, we could view it as a larger container model. We could think about some of the components that go in to maybe making more complicated models if that's what we truly wanted. And that being said, there's actually, even on the modeling side of things, an impetus, and I'll leave everyone to their independent opinions on how valid it is, but the VICBC, the Vanderbilt Integrated Cancer Biology Center, and a bunch of other ones like it, they're charged with making a virtual tumor. So the NIH wants something very, very complicated. They don't want an insightful model, they want an accurately predictive model. And if you're gonna have an accurately predictive model, then you have to have lots of crazy complicated things that in turn are based on what's been measured very accurately. But if you want a more classical mathematical model that lends insight into the system, then you probably want something much, much simpler than what I present. So this is maybe halfway between what you want eventually, what the NIH wants and what maybe some of us really want. But that being said, what we have is we have a proliferating cell population, and we give them a genetic or phenotype, actually more of a phenotype I, and it's going to be distributed in space, denoted by X, and that could be three dimensions, two dimensions. What we'll look at is two dimensions, but in the model it's general. Age A, cell size S, and time T. And so if we're proliferating, we see we've already undergone some kind of mutation, and let's say it's P, for just to give it a name, we'll call it P53. And then following that, we have this linear sequence of mutated genotypes that Sandy spoke about this morning. Not terribly different when you go into the model to put a mutation that isn't linear, but if we're talking about, I think someone with more biological expertise mentioned earlier, if we're talking about cancer, ones that go down in aggressiveness sort of disappear from the population anyway, and so it's a reasonable assumption. And then along with those, the corresponding same genetic type, well, cells can go quiescent, so we have a quiescent population. And then I believe, I'm not sure if Sandy's changed it much, but it's the model species for the chemicals are exactly the same as what Sandy had. We have a tissue macromolecule concentration distributed in space and time, MDE in space and time, and oxygen, or whatever nutrient you prefer in space and time. Now, because we're dealing with individuals that are distributed in both size and age, we need a notion of the real number of cells. And so what we do is we have to integrate over all sizes and all ages of our proliferating cells and over all genetic types. And that gives us the number of actual, or the density of actual proliferating cells. And we do the same thing for quiescent cells. We actually don't track necrotic cells, and in the newer versions we will, but and that's not a scout's honor, that's a real honor, that we're going to put the necrotic cell, it shows us what we actually have with the tumor as opposed to just a front of a tumor. So there'll be eventually an M of XT for the dead cells, and then the N of XT is the total tumor population density. Well, here it's what we call total tumor population density, but it's proliferating plus. So this is the main equation that we have, and it's for the proliferating cells. And so the time evolution of class PI, well, we say cells age, and so this is the first derivative. And that's actually, it's kind of an innocuous looking term. Out of all the terms up there, it's the most friendly looking. It has the shortest, you know, physical length in terms of how wide it is. And it's a simple little derivative, and it's not terribly frightening.
So I would call those the web terms.
Yeah, those are the first line are the web terms, that's true. The first line are Glenn Webb, and that's actually Glenn's 1989 model right there. But if you don't handle aging correctly in your numerics, that little tiny, what was the name of that movie? One where he had a little furry one and they got water on it and went really angry. Well, that'll happen if you don't do the numerics way. Then we also have cell growth. And really what's important is that it depends on size S, these growth characteristics. If you don't have an S there, if I toss this S out, then actually I can make a change of variables and I can embed size structure into age structure. So having an explicit S there is important if you're going to retain that term. But the way we're going to actually handle it is we're going to essentially chuck that. We're going to say that any meaningful changes in size aren't there. It's really just a, but again, this was just an embedding of Glenn's 89 model into a bigger model. Then we have a Sandy Hat, exactly the same, diffusion, haptotaxis, cell death from insufficient oxygen, division with sufficient oxygen, and an exit to quiescence and an entry from quiescence with some problem. And this is one thing you want to notice and is that this is division with sufficient oxygen, but it has a minus term. So this is a sink. The reason it's a sink is what we're doing is we're assuming symmetric cell division. And that at division, the two new cells are, you know, brand spanking new. They're as good as, you know, as good as can be. And so this is the removal of the parent cell. And then what we do is we put back at age zero. That's why it's sort of a kind of a birth term. We put back two new cells. And so, and depending on whether they've mutated or not, they go back. They either belong to their current class, or they belong to the class, the next most aggressive kind of phenotype class. Now, that being said, I said you make two new cells, and I have a factor of four. So where did that come from? Oh man, so there's a four there, and it says the question mark. Let's make sure the question. So we have some generic division kernel. So this is the division rate. And when you divide, you get two new cells. And if you don't have symmetric division, then you have some sort of kernel. With some probability, you get a certain size from that cell. But now you make the assumption that we have symmetric division. And so you're no longer integrating over all sizes U here. You're just integrating over one size of two U hat, double the size of the baby cell, or the new child cell. And so you get a Dirac delta function there. And now you want to make this change of variables. And so when you make the change of variables, you get this 2 here from the change of variables. It's just calc, I think SMU is calc 2. And you pull out that 4. So when I saw this, I wrote Glenn, and I said, you made a mistake. He said, no, I didn't. And he showed me this. And then when we had this paper review, we were told you made a mistake. And I was able to say, no, we didn't. And I sent him this sort of thing. And I think we eventually put it in the paper because it's kind of a quantum, you know, it's very unintuitive. You have cell division and it's giving you a factor of 4, but it's just, it's SMU calc 2, which is not. Now we're saying quiescent cells are born from proliferating cells of the same mutation class. And we included cell aging, and that's how we solved the equations and did things. And then we thought about it and said, well, the cells are still aging, they're still transmitting the cell cycle, and we really use age, but that's not really being very quiescent. So that's wrong, but it's in the equations. Then we say that, well, you know, quiescence means you're docile, so you're not moving. And it's not that you're not moving as much. So what we need to do and what we put back is we put back the diffusion and haptotaxis, but just with smaller coefficients, less activity. So this is an incorrect equation, but it's the one we solved. And in terms of the software and the framework, it really doesn't change much. It does change a little because if these guys don't age, but they have age in the moving grid formulation, they actually can't be solved with that discretization. but they don't have any age variable to integrate, and so what you have to do is we have to do a sort of a little local extrapolation between two different age groups. That's, from a numerical standpoint, it's trivial, but it wasn't officially included in the original method, so it's technically a new thing. And then they exit and enter proliferation. And I think they should have they should also have a death term. I don't know where it went in the slide, but it should be there.
Yes. First of all, if you use the method of currency, can you get rid of T and A? I don't know if it makes life easy to do that.
Yes. So the method, the Ludwig-Milligan method, integrates along characteristics. You can't just do everything along characteristics because you're coupled in very important ways. So this one actually is not going to have an age structure. So this is going to be gone. So how we treat this one is important. But this equation, in terms of at least the age structure, is correct. So we toss out the sign and we have this. But remember, so we have this, and as far as we see, there's nothing coupling things. But then when we go here, what happens is, in order to know this at zero, I have to know the whole population. And so when you're looking at these methods of characteristics, let's say this is age and this is time. This matters. These characteristics have slope one, right? But I want to know what's going to happen here. And know what happens here, I have to know everything along here. So I actually can't consider each of these characteristics as a separate problem and solve them independently because they're coupled across this direction. And so that prevents you from just replacing that with a total derivative. You can't just replace it with a total derivative and go forward. Unless you have some very nice assumptions. If this is a constant, well, yeah, you can pass the integral through and then you get rid of h. H becomes true, so that becomes not important. But as we saw in the original formulation, you don't have cell division in gap one, so it can't be a constant. It has to be something else.
So theta, remind me again, theta was the little graph you showed in the beginning?
Yeah. Okay. And then the chemical species are, I think, almost identical. They're not almost, not, I think maybe we added an uptake term or something that should have been in Anderson's 2005.
Somebody should tell me how fibronectin gets to produce oxygen.
Okay. So I'll say something about this. So, we talked about, I mentioned two things. The NIH's virtual tumor. When you do the NIH's virtual tumor, you've got to have biochemistry down pat. But if you're going to say, what we're interested in is, how does the population dynamics of the population genetics, so meaning the cell cycle and these mutation progressions, how do those affect the tumor? With some, let's say, some qualitative understanding. Then I'm not even sure you want all three of these. You just say, well, it's some reasonable approximation, the cells degrade the matrix and move into the matrix. And that removes a lot of your parameters and you're able to focus on some other things. But yes, if you want something to be highly accurate and highly predictive, then you need to get the biochemistry right. And maybe this is something that's, by being halfway in between, accomplishes that. So I don't, but that's not my department. So the simplified model, we ignore the size structure. We're only going to use one genotype phenotype class. In the current one, we're going to use two or three. We haven't decided. And we're going to consider only two spatial dimensions. But this is still a system with four independent variables. Still, essentially, from a mathematical standpoint, a three-dimensional problem. Age, time, and two in space. Okay. So how are we going to compute this? Well, one of the things I want to do with age structures, I want that little innocuous term, gizmo, that was the guy's name. I want gizmo to stay gizmo and not become a gremlin. So what we want to do is we want to keep the number of age nodes pretty down. And these distributions are actually pretty smooth. They're pretty easy to approximate, especially because we use them mostly in terms of integrals of things. And so when you're integrating something, you could be rougher still in your approximation. And so we're going to use this method, what I call moving Rydberg method, to reduce age of space structure PD to a system of parabolic equations. And each of the age groups will be decoupled because we'll lag any sort of total populations that things depend on. Those capital N's, those capital P's, capital Q's, those, they're changing so slow that we'll handle those explicitly in the numerics. and everything else we can handle implicitly because they can be quite stiff. And then an ADI method, an alternating direction implicit method, splits the elliptic operators into 1D operators. And then we embed the ADI method in the step doubling method for time integration. So I want to move the system from time t to time t plus delta t. And so what I do, and this is step doubling, is I'm going to do one step that goes out to t plus delta t, and I'm going to do two steps to go from first to t plus delta t over 2, and then t plus delta t. And that's going to give me two things. The first thing is I have two solutions, so I can compare them, and if they're close, or reasonably close, and within some tolerance, I've taken a reasonable step, and so I have step size control, I have adaptive time stepping. Then, what I can do is, these are two steps of backward Euler, I could actually take two times this solution and subtract off this solution, and I've now subtracted off my first order error, so I have a second order correct method. And I've proven already that this works for parabolic equations. Now I said, okay, I have this 1D code and we want to do 2D. I really wanted 2D because I felt that, you know, just regular spheres weren't going to impress any biologists, that I had to have bumpy circles instead of smooth circles. So I really wanted 2D, and I go, I'll get you 2D, and I'll get you 2D with this clever idea I think I have. So I embedded ADI into the step doubling. And so we take a step first just diffusing in X and the zero and the zero order terms. And then we diffuse in Y. And so each of our substeps involves first going diffusing in one direction and then diffusing in the next direction. And initial analyses, but not a full proper convergence analysis, show that this is this retains the second order correct method. And it's adaptive. And if it does that, this actually is probably a better alternative to what's been the dominant ADI method for now about 30 years, which is called strain splitting. And so the hope is that we can prove the convergence properly and popularize that method. But the core of the idea here, and the most important thing, is the age method. So the previous methods, they integrate in the age time playing along these characteristic lines. So what we do is we go, we say, okay, we're going to move the system, and we're going to evolve each of these groups along these lines. And we're going to use a fixed age grid, because that's the first thing that comes to mind. And then once we have our method, we're not going to actually use it, so we're never going to figure this, the rest of the part out about what we've, you know, put into the literature. And we're not going to realize that this requires delta A to be equal to delta T to be a constant. And I wrote inefficient in practice, but a better term is crippling or completely useless in practice, because when you have space, these time steps are going to be very small. And I have problems, I have straw man problems where the efficiency is about a loss of about a factor of 10,000. I have practical problems where the loss of efficiency is about 1,000. And I've never seen anything where you did better than a factor of 50. So at worst, you do 50 times better by doing what I do. And in practice, you could do about 1,000 times worse by not doing what these guys did. But of course, they never found that out because they only did computational methods, not computational methods and results. So to understand more fully, I have some illustrations of this fixed grid. So not a, it's not an ed grid, it's a fixed grid. And what you see is, well, we have these characteristic lines. So what this says, what these lines mean, so we should probably explain characteristics for some non-mathematicians. What this says is that a year from now, I'm going to be a year older. So age and time advance together. So an individual at, let's say, you know, the onset of our simulation has some age, let's say at this point. Well, if we go a time step, delta t, they're going to go out here. But we said we're going to use a fixed grid in age. And so this point and this point, they have to align so that I get these nice little right triangles. And so if I use a fixed grid, then delta a has to equal delta t. Now, once you realize a fixed grid method of characteristics isn't going to work, you could do things like Eno and Leno schemes and all the fancy things that people have for very complicated conservation laws and transport equations and flow equations. But those are still going to not be, they're not going to be as effective for something like this. And so instead what we're going to do is we're going to keep with our method of characteristics, but instead we're going to move the grids along the grid points along the characteristic lines. So now, instead of having a fixed grid, I can have an irregular grid, and I move my points along these characteristics. something has to happen at this point. This point moved here, but I still need an interval to define my birth interval. And so I'm going to introduce a new point here, and I have all these points. But if I do that, every time I take a time step, I introduce a new age point, I've just gone back to the original problem. I'm going to have just as many, or if I take tons of little tiny time steps, because my spatial problem is so hard, I take tons of tiny little age steps, because every time I have to introduce a new age step. So instead, what I have to do is I have to say, well, I'm not going to introduce a new one every time. Some points, I'm going to lengthen this interval, and then I have to count for that mathematically. And one thing that this happens to do, this approach, is I no longer have to approximate an age derivative. Everyone in this interval became older by just the right amount, by moving what their interval was defined to be. And that's going to underlie some of what are called the superconvergence properties in these methods. So there's a notion of a cohort that underlies this that I think has this intuitive, sort of a biological intuition or a natural intuition. And so you can think of it as corresponding to different notions of aging and what constitutes a cohort. So usually when we think about how old we are, we have chronological age, and it's measured in years. Very young children, we will measure things in weeks and months, but after about, once you get 2 years, you no longer do that. You use years. And so every year on our birthday, we change the group we're in, and we become a year older. And so currently, I'm in the cohort of 35-year-olds. But in the moving discretization, individuals do not change cohorts. Rather, the cohort as a whole ages. And so I graduated high school in 1989, and for the rest of my life, that graduation year doesn't change. And so I have friends who graduated at the same time as I did, and we're in this context, we're in the same group, and so we never have to figure out which one of us are together, whereas I have a buddy who has a birthday a month ahead of me, and so for 11 months out of the year, we're in the same age group, and for 1 month out of the year, we're in a different age group. And so my claim is if we think about age just in the right way, in terms of a class age rather than a standard chronological age, we could solve the problem without doing much at all. So we have to think about what happens in the first birth interval. And so it's just a simple conservation process. So ignore death and diffusion. Over time step dt, we have a conservation law. Delta A nu equals U nu equals delta A old, U old. So we have densities. So the width of the new interval times the height, density, we're thinking we have maybe a piecewise constant approximation. So each interval has one density assigned to it. You can think of it as a bucket with water in it. So if I want to know how much water is there, I need to know the area of the base, and I need to know the height of the water in the bucket. And that's going to equal to whatever water was in that smaller bucket. So the size of the base, size of the interval times the height, plus what was born into it over that time step. And again, because time advances with age, delta A nu is going to equal delta A old plus delta T. We do some algebra, and we get something that looks like this. On the left-hand side, we have something that looks like a time derivative. And on the right-hand side, we have the birth term, but we subtract off this term in red, U nu. And so what this does is this term accounts for the lengthening of that first interval. And so, for example, if we weren't adding anything at all here, all we were doing was lengthening that interval. What we would need is, in order to keep the total amount of individuals in that interval the same, we would have to lower the density. And that's why this would appear like a sink term with no birth. And so once we have this notion of cohort, what we get to create is a Galerkin finite element method. So we use a subspace in age that moves along these characteristic curves, the ABT. So I define some sort of piecewise polynomial, and it's going to move along these characteristics for me.
Are you going to tell us what a finite element?
I probably should. So what you do, you take the variation form. So I take my equations, and I multiply the solution by a function, and then I integrate by an arbitrary function, and then I integrate in space and age. And that's called the variational form, or weak form of the equation. And then the magic of the Galerkin method is I go in, and I use lowercase letters, and I replace all of those with uppercase letters, and that solves my equation form. Well, I'm being facetious. So the lowercase letters represent true solutions. And they're in some very, very large or very general infinite dimensional function space, and then the capital letters, they belong to what's called finite, hence the term, well, these are very often called, you know, hence the term finite element. They'll belong to a finite dimensional subspace, typically polynomials. So all we're doing is we multiply the equation by a whole bunch of stuff, integrate, and then we say that our solutions are going to be approximated by piecewise polynomials. So instead of these complicated curves, we're going to have it. Most typically, what I'm going to use are these piecewise constants. And so if I have a function that looks like this, I'll say, well, I'll use a step function like this. And maybe, well, one that does a better job of approximating the average values over the intervals of what I drew. But in general, we'll use something like this. Or we'll use lines, and we'll use discontinuous lines so that we actually get something that instead looks like, instead I also have one that looks, and so I would use, and the key is we want these to be discontinuous. We don't want to join the edges because we want each age group to be able to be treated independently. So that's a critical part of using the discontinuous polynomials. Unfortunately, and I'll discuss this in a bit, and I'm way over, aren't I? No, I was at 3:30. Okay.
Yeah.
The unfortunate part for me of using these discontinuous polynomials is now everyone thinks this is a discontinuous learning method. So I get to, I have to explain why it's not all the time. But anyway, that's essentially what we're doing, is we're replacing these curves by these sorts of functions. And so here's an example of a discontinuous piecewise linears. But what we do, so what do I mean to move it along these intervals? Well, I want a rigorous way of saying when do we introduce a new interval, when do we not introduce a new interval? And so I say, okay, what I'm gonna have is, I'm gonna have some number C0, and that's gonna be at the start of my simulation, I'm gonna have individuals of a maximum age. And then I'm going to do negative indexing, so I'm going to go from 0, minus 1, minus 2, I plus 1, I minus 1, out to minus infinity. And that's going to be fixed for all time. I'm going to have something that goes out as far as I need. And this is a theoretical nicety. For the ones way down the road, we can define them as we need them. Because then what I'm going to do is...
The boundary functions. What are the boundary functions?
In age? What we'll do is, for space, we'll use no flux. And then, remember the birth condition I talked about, the cell division? And so the boundary condition is the birth condition, so non-local condition. So it's this one here. So H0, we have this condition. And so it's a non-local boundary condition, which is sort of, it's why we can't. It's this non-local boundary condition that prevents us from just solving everything along characteristics. In this model, it wasn't for the non-local boundary condition. Okay. And so I put this up, and it's a little bit complicated because it's an abstract function space. But this is sort of the heart and soul of the method, is this finite dimensional subspace. Because when I talked about taking those functions in an arbitrary space, multiply by a function and you replace it with one with a capital letter one. Well, the capital letter one lives in this space here.
What's an L2?
Huh?
What's an L2?
L2 means if you square the function and you integrate it, you still get something back. So. Now, the moving Grignard method is a discontinuous Grignard method source. We use discontinuous piecewise polynomials. But it has an important additional property. Movement of the grid computes the age transport. And so normally in these discontinuous learning methods, you get jump terms. You don't have defined derivatives between these intervals, and these jump terms are actually what are helping you out. But here we don't have those jump terms, so there's no error from discretizing derivative age, and nor from integrating the jump discontinuities, except in the first interval. The first term essentially has that penalty term we showed you when I did the simple case is essentially a discontinuous Galerkin-like term. And so one of the advantages of this method is that the error comes solely from the approximation. So So to remove all the jargon, all the math, and all the formalese about the Glerken method that I put in, quite simply, I have a curve, I replace it by a series of flat lines, and then this curve is evolving in age. Essentially, if no one's dying, then this thing's just moving this way, right? And so I just move my straight lines this way. And if someone gets knocked out here, I knock out the straight line, the flat line that corresponds to it. So that's all there is. I have a distribution, and I'm replacing it by some sort of approximation. And as it moves, it's moving with a predetermined velocity, velocity one. I know that velocity, and so I'm able to move my grid with that velocity, so I don't have to worry about it.
Bruce?
Yes.
Yeah. So by the way, because I'm not very familiar with the discontinuous kind of method, but I know like ordinary finite element can use kind of like best function. So what's the benefit of using discontinuous kind of
method? So in my case, the reason I use a discontinuity, the important thing for me using the discontinuity is that I want, it's basically the linear algebra. If I don't do that, each of these groups, they have to be solved all at once. So all of them have to be put together in the same huge matrix, and then they're gonna have to be solved all at once. If I use discontinuous functions, then each aim group gets its own little micro equation that's easy to solve. And so I've really decoupled everything. And also it's a natural parallelization, so I wanna parallelize this, I just parallelize across age groups. And it's what's called embarrassingly parallel. There's no thinking to do, it's already parallel algebra.
So for edge group, we can do this, but how about like special distribution?
Oh, for space, I use, so when I wrote the method, just for generality, we used the most vanilla Glerken method there was out there. And then in practice, I used the this ADI method, so center finding differences in each direction. So convergence, 2000, Science Journal, American Oscillator 2000, I showed second order convergence for the piecewise constant case. So that constitutes one order superconvergence. Piecewise constants are generally only first order correct. But what we can do is one of the properties of these little lines is that the midpoint values are second order correct. So I can connect the dots and get a continuous piecewise linear approximation as second order correct. But more importantly, the reason I can do that is each of those lines approximate the average value quite well. Second order correct to average value. So when I want to integrate that for total populations and the like, I don't even have to do the post processing. I just add up my values to the second order correct.
What's a BPA?
Huh?
What's a BPA?
That's me. And then with Todd DuPont, I did
that was biological.
We did the general. then with Todd, my old thesis advisor in Chicago, we showed convergence for general spaces. So the discontinuous piecewise linears and higher, and so forth. But we only prove one extra power of superconvergence when you actually double the error. So if we use discontinuous piecewise linears, and I've gotten it in practice, you actually get a fourth order. You post-process it to qubits, and you get fourth order convergence. And then for step doubling, we haven't shown it for ADI yet, but with Todd again, and it appeared MathComp just last year. Well, we showed it for variable time steps, which hadn't been shown before. It's something that, as Todd mentioned, someone should have proven it in the 1950s or 60s. Or probably 60s, I think Gear really popularized it starting in the 60s. But no one did it when they should have. Bramble and Salmon did a much more general class of methods, but only did it for fixed time steps. And so the analysis was left to do, but Todd in particular, and because he's so influential on me, now me, are particularly fond of this method. I think it's very simple, and it should be more popular than it is. And so proving the convergence was considered to be an important thing. It was a nice little math result. And then I have now it's a 10th by now, it's approaching, I think September will be its 10th birthday. There's a little software toolkit I wrote when I was a graduate student. I've gotten some people to use it.
You call them bugs?
Bugs. So I was thinking of a name, and
then I would use a software program named Bugs.
Well, so the history behind it is this was one of my first endeavors, and it took me a little while to debug it. And so Todd said, "Well, I have a name for it," so I took the name, and so the acronym stands for Bruce's General Song. But the only person who's used it and cited it is Michael Brenner. And Petros used it, Petros has a student using it, and Todd uses it for little things. I think he has some evaporation problem that's pretty, that got some good press, and I think he used bugs for that. So. Okay, so now let's go back to the two of them. So, first thing I want to talk about is we have 22 parameters. And what I did was I grabbed them out of Sandy's paper as best I could. And depending on how well you think his parameters are motivated, I have an and or based on Anderson. With that being said, Sandy and Vito Quaranta at Vanderbilt and a whole bunch of labs there are finding the parameters are more or less, or most of them is finding that they're finding are in agreement with what you previously used and so forth. But there's some translational work to get things in terms of age structure as well. And then didn't quite know what the haplotaxis should be, so I just went crazy with that. And so that's nowhere near what it should be. But one of the things, and this is generally current work, they're working on numbers, well, not just for one kind of, one of the big things is because we want to study multiple lines, multiple phenotypes, is they're getting parameters for different for cell lines with different levels of aggressiveness and so forth. And so NSLVI, CBC stuff, and Sandy's closer to it than I am. I basically every once in a while ask him how things are going, you know, maybe tell me. And one of the things I wanted to do was I wanted to strain the software, so I cranked up the haplotaxis quite a bit. And so we're going to get some pretty steep gradients and some stiffness in the ODE system. And once we do that, well, I can get a circle with bumps on it. I'm not, not making any claims that that's a meaningful scientific result. And right now I just show the plot for the proliferating cell density. Because of how we, because we didn't give any movement to the quiescent cells, I get a similar picture for them, but they lie just inside the proliferating cells. And on the inside are all the necrotic cells, on the outside are nothing, but because I wasn't tracking necrotic cells, they both look like nothing. And the way we get the bumpiness is quite artificial. We put in a highly heterogeneous environment. And but as I said, the gradients are quite steep. When this thing goes around, it's really degrading everything. And so so that's that.
So where the matrix is fitting into your system of equations? So which kind of effects is this matrix?
So these were Sandy's equations that Howard loves. And so we have the matrix gets degraded, but it gets degraded by a degradative enzyme, which is produced by the proliferating cells. And then that also releases, and then what, fibronectin releases oxygen. So, so one thing is you're only seeing the tips. So if I, that's one of the reasons we want to put it, put back the necrotic cells that you would see a population that these are just, this is just the front. And so.
Is there a length scale in here at all?
No, there actually isn't. This is,
but in your brain, is there one?
Yeah, what we're going to do, and I can actually go through and do the proper parameters, is this is going to be about centimeters. But things are done more properly, and not for illustrative purposes of the methodology, then that's the scale, that, at least that's the scale that Sandy wants it to be, is about the, is the centimeter scale.
I mean, on the next picture, what do we see exactly? I mean, because I would expect them, this is a fingering.
No, this is these guys aren't diffusing or anything. This is just the matrix being degraded. And so as they, as they move, they eat things away, and so.
What's your quantum finger?
The cell fronts. Was the cell, as the proliferating cells migrate into the matrix, they chewed away.
Oh.
So what you did. So.
Yeah, I mean, I would expect if you have one finger, you know, going through the matrix, and you would also only see one finger.
Yeah, but there's also quite a bit of diffusion. There's more diffusion in here than needed to be there.
Okay.
So.
He wants you to give him the finger.
So one of the, so this is actually one of the things where we have to fix. So in this one, if I want, so I have this problem. I wanted to get these guys to move faster upgraded, so I cranked up the half taxes parameter. Well, then I'm getting, you know, I'm getting things that are approaching blow up or they're becoming very stiff. So then I crank up diffusion, and that kills that same behavior. And the what I really need to do is I need to have something, some sort of notion of density put in, that you can't get a singularity of cells at a particular spot that doesn't make sense. And I have to think about how to do it in some manner that's at least halfway reasonable. But that's again another thing, that thinking about how to do things more properly, we have to think about, you know, how to incorporate crowding. Because you can't go into the matrix until you've degraded the matrix, right? And so we have to balance space occupancy in some manner.
Yes. By the way, with such a kind of genius extra set of measure, why is the front of the cell still looks pretty uniform?
So, because there's a lot of diffusion. But also, actually the front looks uniform, but if you look back here, there's actually holes, and these holes propagate. So these holes are the tips of fingers. So this gap here, there's no cells there. Well, there's also none flowing back for a little way. So that's another reason why I have to put the necrotic cells, so the pictures look like what people expect to see. So that's what
the necrotic cells.
They're not in there. They're not in there. Right? They're the black stuff. So the necrotic cells look like, you know, like nothing. And that's
black hole.
Yeah. So, no pretense that I've aided any understanding of cancer biology. But the hope is now that we have you know, sort of the software and modeling framework, when Vito or someone else at Vanderbilt tells Sandy something, or tells Glenn something, or tells me something, that we can turn around and we can, you know, put it in quickly and see what they want. And so, well, so what are some of the model refinements? Get the parameters and the length scales and everything down. Go and deal with units like you're supposed to, and so forth. Like I said, the aging should have been in the quiescent cell equation, so we've got to toss that, we've got to put back in, we've got to put diffusion. Put in that explicit necrotic cell population so that we get pictures that look like something. If you have fingering, you actually get to see the fingering rather than have invisible fingering. And think about density dependence of the haplotaxis term. And one of the goals of this, as I said, is to put this under chemotherapy. And then so now we have to think about how do you model chemotherapy in this model. And that is very, very preliminary in terms of the ideas. And
there's no anti-angiogenesis.
I mean, to model the chemotherapy, kind of have to figure out how to model the blood vessels, where the oxygen is coming from.
So this has to be done in a better manner. But that's why this doesn't get a bullet, because it's a lot harder. So the other ones get a bullet because those are things I can do now. And then the one that doesn't get a bullet are the things that I have to basically do.
Question.
Huh? What?
David.
Oh, what?
Well, you could go back to the 4-5 slide, but quite a few of us interested in this equation.
Which equation?
That one.
No.
The AT one?
Yeah.
I want to know what the pH is.
So, understanding the effects of acidity on age structure is an area of future research.
Just stole my question.
I thought it was quite a few of them.
So what am I doing in terms of, so that's what the model needs to be done. Glenn really likes psi structure, wants to see what the rule is. So I want to put together some nice methods for psi structure. And also he's done some work already with continuous representations and different genotypes. And so again, thinking about that. These all come into these, you know, with the linear sequence at least. If we keep the assumption linear of monotone progression, maybe not linear is no longer the right word. These fall into the general category of what are called physiologically structured variables, and so you can handle them with methods and characteristics that are similar to what I've done. And then some other biological systems. So the very first system that, you know, I put under the rubric structured multiscale was actually what motivated my interest, and I developed it misinterest and worked on these guys. Actually, I spent a summer in James Shapiro's lab at the University of Chicago with these guys, so I've autoclaved things and thought about buying myself an autoclave at 1.2. And here,
buy
there's
none. Buy
none.
So, anyway, here the movement is a degenerative diffusion problem. So it's very similar. It's a diffusion-like thing. So the equations and the code and everything look very similar to what we've done for the tumor invasion. Then one of the things is they like us when they keep us here for a long time at IPAM to work with each other. And so Isaac has a lot of really nice stuff on biofilm, and there's one particular problem that involves cell aging and cell age structure, and so we're doing that. But now, instead of having diffusion, we have some sort of Darcy flow problem. And then there's also forest models, and well, trees don't move, but seeds do, and so the seed is done by dispersal currents. And if you want details of the talk, there's a paper in multi-scale modeling and simulation that